Welcome to Just Now Possible with Teresa Torres.
I'm Sally Ann. I'm actually the director of product here at Arise. I come from a technical background. I actually started off on the data science side of things. I never really saw myself going into product. About 2.5 years ago, I made my transition over, and I like to be really technical. I lean in heavily with the engineers, especially on the project that Jack and I are here to talk about. But yeah, I think what I'm really excited about is building really like AI native products, and I'm super thrilled to be here. Jack.
My name is Jack. I'm staff engineer here at Arise. I've been here for about 3.5 years, and currently Sally and I are leading our team building out our AI products. In the past, I came here from Lyft, where there I mostly worked on our pricing team. So I had a little bit of exposure there to ML and building ML systems, and excited that I got to continue in that vein of experience here at Arise. And I'm really excited to talk about what we've been building.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so tell me a little bit about Arise, your product, and then I'm sure we can talk a little bit about the product in general, and then let's get into the AI-specific feature or product that you've been working on.
So we're Arise AI. We really do, I think, three things like really well. We work on tracing, observability, evals. Those are like the three core components. And from all of that, it really allows you to then improve your AI application. And so what we're going to talk about today is Alex, our AI agent that we built into our platform that's supposed to help you across the board of all the things that I just mentioned. And we'll talk about this a lot, but it's been a really cool experience because we actually used Arise to build Alex. We're building Alex for Arise, but we are using Arise to do it, which is a really cool experience.
Okay, I already want to break down some terms. So tracing, observability, and evals, can you maybe tell me what each of those things are?
Yeah, there's a little bit of overlap, I think, with those. So traces, if anybody here is familiar with a Datadog for APM, your application traces, you can think of traces as like a collection of steps that an application is taking, especially in the Gen AI world, like an input and an output. It's all the steps that it took to take an input and then all of the go all the way to getting an output at the end. It could be something as simple as calling an LLM, calling OpenAI to get an answer, but oftentimes there's a lot of other steps that are taken. Grabbing data, using an external API, formatting data, calling to a vector knowledge base. And so you can get these really complex traces. And so Arise allows you to observe these steps and understand the steps that your application has taken. And then there's the evaluation piece, which is a lot of times these things are like black boxes in some ways. Yeah. You can't use your traditional metrics. Okay, sure, you could do error count or latency or cost, but that doesn't really tell you why you're getting a bad response, right? And so we have evaluations, which are going to be your primary performance signal for these applications. And so it could be something meta called LLM as a judge, where we're asking another LLM to then judge something about our application, but you can also do them in code. I think a very simple example of this is like QA correctness. Look at the input, look at the output. Was it the correct answer to the question? And then I think we'll get into it as we talk, but then there's various levels of complexity to that and like how you approach your evals, all the different things that can tell you. That's kind of like my high level pitch on what each of those things are.
I love it. So for our folks that are just getting started with this, it's really as simple as like a trace is all the things that's happening in the back and forth between a user and an LLM, or even broader than the LLM if there's other tools involved. And then observability is how do we look at that data so we can figure out what's working and what's not working. And then evals are getting into let's put some metrics around that. Those metrics can be a little more complex than typical product analytics. And then Arise is helping with all three of those areas.
Exactly. And then using all of that to improve. I think that's like the really important piece. And that's where Alex comes in to play as well.
Awesome. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, so Alex is the product that you're building, or that Alex is live in the product today.
Yeah, Alex is just today. You can go try it out.
Okay. So let's get into the kind of the story of Alex. Alex is an AI agent that you built inside your tool. Where did this idea come from? Tell me about the inspiration.
We started Alex, I think we started talking about it in the fall of like 2023. And back then, our product is actually mostly focused on like traditional ML. So you can think about like classification or ranking or regression models. And what we found is that like our product had a lot of like really advanced features. And the point is that when a user, you know, detects like a degradation in one of their models, you can use our product to really drill deep into, okay, is it this feature that's causing an issue? How is this feature causing the issue? And then what can I do about it? And you can do that all in our product. We found that sometimes that flow was a little bit too advanced for people who are particular users who are like new to using our product. And what we, our revelation was that when customers spend a lot of time with our solutions architects, with our customer success engineers, they are able to actually find and root cause issues in minutes, and they're actually like able to get real insights. And even after these types of pairing sessions with our engineers, they're able to use our product in a much more advanced way. So our kind of genesis of what, and back then it was actually called Copilot, now it's called Alex. not the most unique name, but our Copilot back then was to emulate this advanced solutions architect kind of persona, someone who is both an expert in our platform and someone who is an expert in these types of machine learning models. And the idea was to codify this experience in a tool that like is obviously self-service. You don't need to actually be on a call with someone at our company to learn how to use their product. So we had two goals. One was for Copilot to string together different analyses. One example is it can see that, hey, you're looking at a chart of performance and there's a dip in performance. And it'll automatically hone in on that like dip in performance. And it'll go through a bunch of other charts. Maybe it'll look at the data quality metrics of, let's say you have 10 features. It'll look at data quality metrics of 10 features and try to see if there's any correlation between maybe one or two or three of those features and that dip in performance. It can also then take that time range and dive deeper into each of those features that may be correlated with your performance drop and look at, okay, what changed about this feature? And if something changed significantly, could that be the cause of your performance drop? So really, it's just if you're an advanced user, looking at multiple charts and correlation, diving deep into individual features. And then the second kind of implicit purpose of this is to show users, hey, look, I found something. Here's a link to a page in our product that shows this graph. And so implicitly is trying to also educate users on how to use our product to debug and how to get the most value out of our product. And again, that's the genesis was all like using Copilot to help users for purely ML products. And I think since we launched, obviously LLMs have exploded. And so we've started taking this tack towards using Copilot Alex to help users with their more LLM applications, which honestly is a much more natural fit. If you're thinking about traditional ML, it's a bunch of numbers, time series. You can imagine, especially back then, we're using GPT-3.5 and terrible at math, absolutely horrible. We're trying to make it work with these statistical methods. It was actually not bad.
I figured out really early on what it was good at and what it was not. And then Jack and I would work to be like, all right, let's do all this math over here and just give it the outcome and it can make a decision from there. But yeah, the math was, it was an interesting lesson.
We still had to do most of the math ourselves and then just feed it to the LLM. Now today, like Sally was saying, all the data that users produce with LLM applications, it's all text, right? And we can see some of these frameworks, it's not just text, but they're just dumping entire Python objects into text. And for a user to try to parse through that just with their eyes, it's basically impossible. So we've taken Alex and shifted it towards more LLM applications, which I think is a much, much better fit for this type of product.
Okay, there's several things you've touched on that I want to highlight that I really love. Okay, so the first thing, I didn't realize this. I recently built my first AI product. I learned about evals along the way. I ended up taking the AI evals course on Maven, which was amazing. And I found myself, the machine learning world has understood this space for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's changed a little bit with LLM-based products, but there's this whole practice that was being done by data scientists and machine learning engineers for some period of time. And I think what's changing, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it feels like what's changing is like any product team can be like, I can write a prompt and stick it in my product. And now suddenly, if I want to figure out if that product is good or not, I very quickly get introduced to this very data science-y machine learning methods and world that like I probably didn't even know I may just be describing my own personal experience. No. But like, I didn't know existed. And yeah. So you have this suite of tools that's like helping people with that. But one of the challenges is they're not even familiar with this way of working. Like they may have just started with, I wrote a prompt. Is that fair?
It's totally fair to say. And I think you can even like, as we talk about like why we built Alex, right? That is part of it. We are definitely seeing that in the Gen AI spaces. Yes. With ML, you had data scientists. You had people who had studied this, knew all the math. They knew how to adjust the model and they knew how to take performance and do something with it, right? And in Gen AI, we have all these different personas. You have the product managers who, yes, they want to make a prompt change. They really understand what the user experience should be. And you have your AI engineers and they care about really like the underworking is the architecture that they built this application. And sometimes you have other stakeholders too, securities involved. Gen AI is high risk. They want to understand like, how are we making sure it's not being jailbroke or it's not creating these really off-brand PRs involved. There's so many different personas and people have different levels of technical abilities. And I think that's part of the reason for Alex. Is like Jack mentioned on the ML side when we first started this, but it was never only about finding an insight. There was a little bit of education involved with it too. Is like, we wanted you to be able to understand, like just not get this magical answer of, yeah, it's broken, but we wanted you to understand, okay, like how did we get to the conclusion that this is broken? Because I think one of the hardest things, and we can talk about this too, and you might have even experienced, is when you're building these applications and you're trying to improve them, there's a certain level of like intuition building that has to happen for you to get to a spot where you can actually take in the data and then do something with it. And that's another thing is like we're trying to build with Alex is like, how can it help you build that intuition faster? Because we don't think there's a way around it. But yeah, we really wanted to allow this to be a tool to help maybe more non-technical folks or the folks who are just starting out be able to get value immediately when they're building these applications.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so then the second thing I wanted to highlight in what Jack said is that you saw this pattern that when your customers talk to somebody on your support team or even an engineer, that was enough for them to start using the product better. And so it was like, okay, how do we scale this? And so it sounds like Alex came out of a very clear customer problem and you actually almost had concierged a solution. Like you knew how to solve the problem. You just needed a way to make it more scalable. Is that fair?
I think a little bit. I think there was definitely some like opportunity we saw and like some bets that we were taking in the future of the industry, but there was definitely a pain there. I actually came from like the CSE background. So I knew firsthand that like we had a problem with the fact that it was hard for folks to get value without first talking to somebody on the CSE team or talking to an engineer. And so there were things that like I knew that the solutions engineers were dealing with every single day. People were coming to them to ask this question. We were like, wouldn't it just be easier if they could just ask Alex? And like even simple things like we added a support skill very early on because I was like, Jack, you have no idea how many times a user comes and asks a question and you have to point them to the docs that they did not read. And so it definitely came from, I think us knowing a little bit of the learning curve to our platform and knowing how involved the CS team needed to be. And then there's just also, we know how repeatable, like debugging an ML application, it's different than the Gen AI, we can get into that, but ML is very repeatable. Like you have like workflows that are tried and true, that have been working for years, that are, the LM can very easily be like programmed, and I use that lightly, to do. And so I think we did know a problem. We knew that we had a really set of repeatable actions that needed to be taken. And we knew that Gen AI was going to be good at it. And then yes, there were also some like bets we took on industry and where we wanted to see things to go.
Okay. So it sounds like you were pretty confident from the beginning that this was the type of task that an LLM would be good at.
Some. I think we knew. The math was always a thing that was a question mark because like they've never really been good. And Jack, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the early prototyping that we did. But I think we felt pretty good about it, just like of our experience of what we were seeing. It's pretty good at giving a task. We did I remember like notebooks very early on where we would take like customer data and we'd have a real insight that like CSEs have troubleshot and we was able to do it. So I think that we were confident. I don't think we were 100% certain that might be fair to say. But Jack, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think, it's a little crazy because you think, oh, LLMs are so capable. And when we were starting this, again, GPT-3.5, you know, it was 50% hallucinations, 50% something useful. It was pretty useful, but a little bit more of a novelty. And the approach we took back then was we put it on Rails. So we used OpenAI tool calling a lot. And the architecture of our Copilot was really like a decision tree, right? So you at the top, maybe the user's, hey, help me figure out what's going on with my model. And you give the LLM maybe four tools that it can call, right? One is debug the performance of my model. Another one could be what Sai was saying, hey, answer a generic like documentation question. Another could be like, hey, help me set up a monitor dashboard. And all the LLM really needs to do is say, okay, the user question is help me debug my model. I have these four skills. Which one do I pick? Okay, I'm going to pick the debug, like model performance skill, because that seems like what the user is asking. And then with that skill, we have maybe four more skills underneath it. It's really an on-rails like workflow experience. And that worked well for what we were trying to do, which is our SAs and CSEs, they've seen enough customer models where they really do have, maybe it's in their head, maybe it's written down, but they have a playbook of, hey, a customer looks like they're experiencing this type of issue. Okay, I'm going to look at this. I'm going to look at this. I'm going to look at this. And they have a pretty well like battle-tested playbook. And we just take that playbook and we convert it into this like structure for an LLM to use. And I think that was back then. And I think today we can see we pretty much every engineer at Arize uses Cursor, the LLM-enabled kind of code editor. And when we use Cursor, and we're starting to use, everyone's starting to use LLMs in real applications and not just generate cartoons of themselves, but really using it to do work. And we're starting to see these examples of, hey, the LLM's like really able to bridge very large gaps between maybe established patterns. And I think what we're doing today is we're starting to rethink the way our Alex works and make it less on rails, like what I was talking about, and give it a little bit more autonomy, a little bit more generic tools that it can try to compose. So we're in this like interesting like phase right now where we're trying to utilize the new powers of LLM model that didn't really exist when we started this project.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Oh, go ahead.
It, just to add one more thing is like, if you really think back to when we started this, it was like, what, November 2023? Like, the concept of an agent didn't work. Or even, like, sometimes people will come to us and we, like, when we are, like, consulting on what we did, it's, oh, what framework do you use? And we were like, there were no frameworks.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, like, us in a dream. And, like, these frameworks, the concept of agent, even us choosing the name Copilot at that time, like, not everybody had a Copilot. And then started to have one. So it is interesting to think of where this industry was when we first started and how much has really been developed since then.
You know, what I love about this is like, I still meet teams that are still, you probably see this too, like people barely understand an agent versus a workflow or like even what's a tool. So yeah. I love that your first version was pretty simple, but still pretty complex and like robust. So you, what I'm curious about is you identified like some common use cases. It sounds like you built tools specifically for those use cases. And the LLM is just pattern matching. Does this query look like it's this tool, and it's picking the right kind of playbook to run. How did you initially decide what to include? Like, I think one of the challenges people struggle with agents is like a user can type in anything.
Totally.
So what, even in that very first version, how did you think about what use cases to solve for? And then how did you handle the use cases that you weren't prepared to handle?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I came into the project probably like a month or two, Jack, you'd say, after they started. So at that point, I think all the ML skills were like figured out. There were like key things we knew. There's going to be like three-ish problems when it comes to ML. You're going to have a performance problem, a drift problem, or a data quality problem. So it was clear, as Jack said, like the CSEs, we had a playbook there. We were like, let's make every one of these into a skill. So we did those. When it came to the Gen AI side, I think there was a little bit of like a lot customer pain. So I think when I looked at the set of skills of this is what I really want this to do, I think we talked through what's the hardest things, like what's a real pain that I can solve. And I can tell you too that were like very easy for us, and it has to do with prompts. One of them was prompt optimization. Is like, so at that point in time, prompts were everything. That is where most like AI application engineers or product managers, they were spending all of their time working on prompts. So we're like, perfect. We should have a prompt optimizer. And so we started with just like giving Copilot, I guess at that time, a skill and just basically a bunch of guidelines it could use to optimize prompts. So that was like very, that made sense. The other thing was like eval templates. We keep talking about evals even here today. to this day, it can be hard to take an idea of, I have this criteria, how do I turn that into a prompt? And so we were like, we should make it an eval builder where I can just ask for something and then it writes the prompt. And I knew from just like working with customers, like that was something that they were really stuck on. So it really was about like taking a look at our customers. What are the things that are the hardest for them to do that have the most value? Prompts, okay. Evals, very high value items, very difficult to do. How do we make it easier? And then from there, I think we followed a similar pattern. I think our first skills were those two. And then we did an AI search skill that was really powerful. We knew that there were certain things that couldn't be done with a simple query language like we have in our platform to filter. You can find like input contains something, but what if I want frustrated users? I can't create a query to find a frustrated user, but the LLMs are very good at looking at text and picking up on those semantic things. So that was like another way. So we really tried to prioritize. There was a bunch. And I think every day, Jack and even to this day, are like, wouldn't it be really cool if Alex could do X, Y, and Z? And we have this backlog doc that has like probably 1,000 skills on it. But we really tried to prioritize the things that we know the LLM will be good at and that we know will provide immediate value. And I think that's usually my suggestion to folks too when they're starting to figure out what the scope is, to try to find, to narrow it down, find a few things to start with, and then you can add to it. We started with, I think, 6 skills when we released Jack. We have 30 today.
Yeah.
So you can build over time.
What I really love about this is something I've seen is that your AI product is not going to do everything right out of the gate. And like making those prioritization decisions has to really be grounded in an understanding of who your customers are and what they're trying to do. And it sounds, because this kind of came out of your CSE team, you were like, here's the most common use cases. If it can help with these things, this is like our highest return on effort. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Well, sorry, we lucked out. The team that like started on this project was me, Sally, who used to be on the CSE team. We had one of our best solutions architects working on this and advising on this every day. And then our CEO, Jason, was very involved. And then actually when I was at Arize, I had a brief stint as a product manager. So all of us had pretty deep like customer experience, like working directly with customers. And then there's a Slack channel like Customer Wins, where other solutions architects will post like, hey, just helped this customer debug this thing. And oh, it was really complicated. We had to go through this many steps. Between our personal experience and kind of these channels or docs logging all of these like customer wins and customer debugging efforts, we had a huge kind of knowledge base of exactly what our customers, exactly the right way for our customers to use our product. And very beginning, we just took that doc and just sorted it by these group of issues are basically the same issues. And there's 10 of these, this next group of issues is there's 7 examples. So we just took that, sorted it, and that's how we started figuring out what to prioritize.
That's amazing. I also love that you're touching on another theme that keeps coming up in my conversations about really multidisciplinary people and very like boundary spanning teams. So what I mean by that second term is like people that play multiple roles or have worked in different roles. And I think AI products are really pushing a need for really genuine cross-functional collaboration. I'm not surprised to hear that everybody on your team has played multiple roles and has that type of background.
One example that I realize is ever since, again, like I said, every engineer at our company now uses Cursor or some other AI agent to help them code or at least learn about the right ways to do things. And now we have engineers who have experience with a product that is a product that we want to emulate and is a very successful product. And we started seeing, as our engineers are building out, especially some of the UI features of Alex, we're starting to see just small things, small changes that they make that definitely are inspired by their own workflows and own use cases of using Cursor or their own AI agents. And it's all these small keyboard shortcuts and other like nice little things that maybe don't ever make it to like a design mock or PRD necessarily. When you see them in the product, you're like, wow, this is a small thing that actually makes a huge difference in my day-to-day usability. And so we have engineers also crossing that boundary to think a little bit more like a product person or at least a user of the product.
Yeah, that's something that I think Claude Code is really excelled at, is just really simple command line interface UI that just keeps people focused on the task and fast.
Yeah.
I want to dig into kind of the early days of this. You had identified a handful of skills. How did you prototype, Alex? How did you get feedback that this was going to work in the early days?
Yeah, we used to have this application that you could spin up locally. It was so bad. So that was the really, so Jack and the early engineers, they built this like little like web app that you could spin up and test. I think we first started, we did lots of notebooks in the beginning to like really prototype some things. But we used to have this, before it even got its own A&R platform, there was this app. It was horrible. I think Jack, after 2 weeks, I was like, I can't do this. It never works for me. He then developed a way that we could run notebooks or run local files and test everything. So we have a really awesome testing framework that allows us to make changes, iterate, test locally without having to worry about any of the UI components or like spinning up the application locally. So we've tried to make it like nimble. So it's just like really easy to test. But yeah, early days, it was notebooks and then this web app. And now we will maybe I will sometimes just create a one-off script or a notebook if there's like a new functionality that I'm like, ooh, I had this idea. And then I'll hand it over to like Jack and our other engineers. But yeah, that's how we used to test. And it's kind of part of the DNA of just really scrappy iteration. We like to like just throw things at the wall and see if they stick. And it was especially true in those early days.
Yeah, I love this. Okay, so I am going to have some listeners that don't know what notebooks are, but I want to dig into this a little bit. So I recently learned how to use notebooks for the first time, and it's because I wrote all my first evals in a notebook because I wanted like somewhere to experiment and try different ways of doing the same eval. What I really wanted was my notes in the same place as my code so that I could keep track of where I am in my experiment. So let me just give a little bit of context for listeners. Coding notebooks allow you to mix like different cells in the same document where you can execute code, you can add notes, you can pull in data, you can visualize data. And I'll make sure in the show notes for people that are new to this idea, I recently did a video where I shared my like eval investigation notebook. And I think this is where notebooks really shine. A lot of data scientists use notebooks to look at the data and to investigate and to slice it in different ways and visualize it in different ways. So it sounds like your earliest version of Alex, you're just playing in a notebook with what can it do and not do. Tell me a little more about that. What did that look like?
Yeah, Jack, I'll let you add. But I think in the early days, it was a lot of what's the best way to get the data? What's the best way? We spent a lot of time on what's the best way to pass data. Like everything that Alex does is anchored to data from our platform. And so there was a whole experimentation of, is it JSON? Is it a CSV, like a comment separated list? What is the best way for it to actually like get the data and adhere to it? So there was a lot of like early testing, of course, like prompt iteration of like, how do we get it to do the task? But it's very hacky. Just here's an idea. Let's try it. Let's try this prompt. Let's try this data. Can it do this skill? Like it was very much just trying to get an idea to work. That's like where we were. When we were working in notebooks, it was like, can we get just something that works? Jack, I'd be curious to see like how you feel.
Yeah, I think like our principles at the very beginning, it was pretty daunting, right? Because it's use AI to make our product better. Okay, here we go. To like figure out where to go from there, I think there are two, I don't know, guiding principles. One is like use real data. When you use fake data, demo data, manufactured data, everything works amazingly, right? And then you bring messy real data that is maybe incomplete or just enormous and you blow through the context limit of your model, or your model just gets confused and focuses on like a small bit when it's not looking at the bigger picture. So I think what Sally was saying is like connecting it to real data is, I think, the first thing that we did. And then the second thing is, luckily our team, even though it's cross-functional, we had our founders involved, we had solutions architects, but everyone that was involved was like technical enough to the point where they can run a bit of code on their laptop, they can start up a notebook or start up the app that we created, so that a lot of different people had access to the prototype that we built. And that really helped us really probe all the like corners and edges of, hey, when we're looking at this kind of data and I ask it this question, oh, the LLM like completely just gets confused and doesn't know. Okay, great. Like now that's we try to get as close to a real customer use case so that we can probe all the edges and try to smooth out all those edges before we start to go into production.
Yeah.
Did you have your CSE team start using Alex?
Yes, I held like weekly dog foodings with them every time we did something. So I don't know if we mentioned, but we started in like November 2023. And then we had like a deadline. We knew in July 2024, we were going to have our conference and we were going to release this. And so Jack and I were on a timeline. Like we knew we had to get this thing in shape. So we just would do weekly dog fooding with new skills or changes. And we would just be like, try it. And then once we started getting into the UI, it was like behind a feature flag so they could demo it or they could try it out in their own time, where if they, we would do a lot of insight docs. Like we would give our customers like insights, like here's a report. And we'd be like, don't do those from scratch anymore. I want you to use Alex and see how close it gets. So they were like a huge help in dog fooding and trying to test. Cause obviously at that time, it really was Jack and I hacking on this. Really for a good majority of the first half, it was just him and I. And so any help we could get with dog fooding and testing and ideas, we would send to them, and they were really helpful in getting that done.
Okay, I want to highlight something that you just said. And I actually, now that I've spent 5 months on my first AI product, 8 months feels really short, but I want to highlight that you started in November and you had a July deadline, mm-hmm. and it felt urgent. Because I think there's so many teams out there that just still frame AI products as I'm going to write a prompt and we're going to release it as a feature. And just all the work that we know goes into it that is not just you're writing a prompt. So let's get into that a little bit. Okay, so you've identified some common use cases. You're dog fooding it internally. You've built out a few different ways to kind of prototype it in notebooks and through this internal kind of web app. How did you start to evaluate, like, how is this consistently good? Can we put it in front of customers? What did that process look like?
Yeah. So I think I also, one thing to call out too about the 8 month, I think if Jack and I were to start this today with all the frameworks and tools that are available to help you, I think we probably could have gotten it done faster, but that was a very short timeline in the beginning.
Oh, for sure. I think my second AI product is going to go much faster, but when you're learning all the, how does this work? What can it do? And especially if you were starting with 3.5. It's just a whole different
game. What happened. We can tell the story of what happened when 4 came out and released and we spoke about what happened and some early learnings there. But yeah, I think that you really think that things are going to go and then you don't really have any signal. Like we talked about this early on of like why evals are so important is there were vibe checks. Like Jack and I were sitting testing with it and we'd be like, oh, that's not really what we wanted to respond with. And then like we'd have one example, like maybe it was the demo model or maybe it was a customer data that we were trying to replicate in real insight. And we would do that in like isolation, right? But then it's like, well, how do I know this works on everything or every time, all data? And that's really where I think evals started to come into play. I don't think we were that great at doing evals early on. I really don't. I think we would do some very simple evals early on. I remember like doing sessions with Jack where we would build out like notebooks that could run evals. This was before our platform had like online evals and all of that good stuff. But I think we just, in the beginning, we're just like trying to get a very simple gut check on how well it was doing, very simple like QA correctness. We weren't really thinking about it at like the systems level that we are doing today when it comes to our evaluation. I would just say like, Jack, I don't know if you disagree, but I really feel like we weren't doing that much evaluation because it was really painful at the time. Yeah. And doing, if we had the Arise product as it is today, then this would be a different story, but we didn't.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this early on is like, we have made some choices for the Arise product as a whole, based off of Jack and I's experience. But like in the early days, we didn't have data sets. We didn't have experiments. We didn't have online evals. We just had a Google Doc with a bunch of examples and our local app. And Jack and I would just sit there and we'd test. And I remember very clearly, because it was so painful, just comparing one output to the original output and being like, did I solve my problem? Okay, no, let me copy that, put that in my doc, and then let me try again. And that's how we really evaluated in the early days.
You know what I love about this story is even at a company that has literally built an eval tool, evals start so messy and so scrappy and so just whatever you can do to make it work. And I think this is actually, I think everybody goes through this. Even now with like really good eval tools, you still have to wrap your head around what an eval is. How do I evaluate good? What does quality even mean? Mm-hmm. And it's such a scrappy, messy process to start, even with good tooling. So I love that was, you went through that as well.
It's tough when you're thinking about traditional testing and traditional ML. There's often like a right answer and a wrong answer. And especially, let's say you're doing ML classification, is it an apple or not? Like it's pretty black and white. And I think with evals, one, we're looking at models and trying to figure out what's wrong. but some very few cases we've heard from the customer, oh, I know what happened and I know what the problem is. In the majority of cases, we look at something like, I think this looks wrong. I think it's this. So we don't even have the right answer. And then in the other types of cases, which is it gave the right answer, but man, it wrote like four paragraphs of text, right? Okay, it's technically correct, but it's probably not a single user is going to read all that text and actually get anything useful. So how do you evaluate like it's correct but useless metrics? So there's a lot of like very ambiguous, like what is a good customer experience? Then how do we codify that as an eval? And getting that point was pretty difficult.
I think, Jack, what you're highlighting on is one of the hardest things about evals is that they'd probably be pretty simple if we could just all objectively agree good or bad.
Yeah.
But usually it's there's 17 dimensions we're grading on, and totally. It could be good on one and bad on the other and pretty okay on one. And just the work to get even to that rubric, like what are the dimensions we're evaluating on? And are they binary? Do they need to be more granular than that? Who's evaluating them? Mm-hmm. Who's the human in the loop deciding this is good and this isn't good? How did you sort that out for Alex? Who did what and how did that evolve?
Yeah, I think it's a group effort. And this is something that we actually suggest to folks. I think the agreeing on the same criteria that you just talked about is a big common misconception with evals that like we offer here at Arise, like we have out of the box templates. We don't use any of them. The idea is to help you get started, right? But we really what we do and what we've done is sit down and think about all the different things that we care about and just started trying to write those out. There's different methods. Haml has a great like Axel coding where you can look at data. But for us, it was really about who cares about what? Like I care about the user experience. Jack cares that the task was done correctly by the LLM. We have security very early on, like somebody tried to jailbreak Alex. And so since then I have a jailbreak eval. And actually 2 weeks ago when I got an alert and I was like, somebody's jailbreaking. And I had to go to the security guy and he was like, wow, I love that you do that. I was like, yeah. So we really say, get all your stakeholders in a room. Like everybody who has something that they care about, if it's security, if it's your product, it's your AI engineers, and just go around and say, what do folks care about? And then start using that as your way to convert them to templates. So our evaluation process today is like very common for any type of like agentic application, which is you're going to evaluate each different level. So we have things that like QA correctness at the top level, but then each individual step that's taking each of those spans really has an evaluation. Did it call the right call the tool with the right arguments? Did it accomplish the task for that tool correctly? I'm trying to think. Was the, like for AI search, was the data even, did the data actually have something in it? And then even we have like trace, like did it call all the right tools in the right order? And then a session, like I care, is my user getting frustrated as it keeps going back with Alex and Alex keeps getting it wrong? Are they just getting more frustrated? Are we losing memory? So yeah, it's just a combination of talking to everybody who's working on it or cares about the application and then just like taking down everybody's requirements and then converting them to emails.
There are so many things you just said that I loved that I want to dig into a little bit. The first thing I want to highlight is you have an evals tool that has off-the-shelf evals and you just said they're meant to help you get started. Yes. Don't stop there. I think this is really critical. I think
it's really important. It is.
For anybody who's started to build an AI product and like really looks at their data and is looking at their traces and seeing what's happened, you are going to have custom errors that an off-the-shelf eval is never going to find for you.
Totally. And it's like that, it's that intuition building I told you about like early on. Like that's the exact key there is you like, you need to be looking at your data and you need to be understanding your own system. You can do QA correctness. That's one of our off the shelf. It probably will work. At Arise, like we not only do like workflows for improving our application, but we actually do them for evals because we feel so like about this because your application's really only as strong as your evals are, right? Like you can only feel so confident in your performance signal as you are in your eval template. So I think that, they're supposed to be a starting point. There are common things, QA correctness. Most people care about that. Hallucination in the use case of RAG. People care about those, but you're oftentimes going to need to adjust those templates and make it work for your data. It depends on what model you're using. It depends about what you care about. It's hard to make. I have six different evals for all of our different tasks because the task correctness cannot be one eval. It's different from my tasks. So it's a process. It's can be painful. I'm not going to say it's like the easiest thing to sift through your data. And that's why we built Alex, right? To try to make it little bit easier, but it makes all of the difference when you're actually trying to get a signal you can trust and then use that signal when it comes to improving.
I'll share, like, looking at the data is not the most fun part in terms of it's really tedious. But if you care about quality in your product, like, it's enjoyable in that way of I can really see what's happening.
Totally.
So yes, the literal task might be a little bit like dull, but what you get from it is so valuable. I'm always surprised when I hear teams like arguing, like they're trying to hand it off the wall, over the wall to somebody else. And I'm like, no, you have to look at it and like really understand what's happening in your product.
Totally. And there's some like fun parts in there too. Like every once in a while, Jack and I will be like, oh, do you like, look what it did here. Oh, yeah. Weird. It shouldn't have done that. But it is interesting that it called those two calls in parallel and it was trying. You like almost understand it. You're like, oh.
Yeah, I know exactly.
I see what you're trying to do there. And it gives ideas sometimes. There have been times that Jack and I have sent each other traces or spans and been like, oh, this was wrong, but like it would actually be cool if it could do this on purpose. And like there are benefits to it. Jack and I spend a lot of time looking at data.
Yeah. Okay, so the other thing I loved about what you said is that your evals operate at different levels, right? So you have evals at the tool call level, you have evals at the session level, you have evals at the like deciding which tool to call level.
Yeah.
I know a lot of teams get overwhelmed with that, especially in complex workflows or definitely with agents, with tool calling. How did you think about where to start? Like, how did you, I'm assuming on day one, you didn't think like, we're going to have evals across all of this. How did you get there? How did you get to where you are?
Yeah, we started just thinking about it as taking more like a systems approach. It's like you're debugging code, right? There's going to be different areas in which you debug it. And so we really just map it out as like decision points. That's how I would describe it. Think about all the different decision points that are happening when the application's choosing a tool or it's choosing to execute a tool. And I think that simplifies it. Like you have a trace with 100 spans. Like that's very overwhelming. You don't need to think about it. It was like, oh, I need to have an eval at every one of those points. What you do need is I need to have an eval at every important decision point that's happened. So for us, it was very clear that we have routers, which are going to be like an LLM step that has a bunch of tools like Jack was explaining. And so we knew that's a very obvious decision point. It took an input and it made a decision on which path to start taking. Let's evaluate that. And then the tasks also make a lot of sense. It needs to accomplish these correctly for everything else to go right. Let's evaluate those. So I spent just recently, I did an audit of this and I had the platform open with all my traces. I had my little iPad where I take my notes and I just went through and I shared the list with Jack after of just, I went through and I was like, oh, yep. Okay. This router, we need to do this. Okay. This span, I should probably like the questions that I'm asking myself even of this do, I'm just jotting those down and it can be overwhelming. I think that you try to reduce it as much as you can and abstract some things away. And the best way I think to do that is what are the decision points and what are the questions you want answers to?
Yeah, that's great. I love the way it's funny. Everybody has their own little mental model. This feels really overwhelming. We can't do all of this right now. Where do I start? Mm-hmm. And so like even just this, what are the key decision points for the agent is really, I think, a great shortcut to, okay, let's just start there.
Yeah. And Arise does have a lot of great frameworks for that and we can help you out. So definitely have great blogs on how to think about this. So check them out if you're having trouble there.
Awesome. I actually did not know Arise had a blog. So I will definitely check that out.
Really great content.
We only have a couple minutes left and I want to be sure to ask what's next for Alex.
Ooh, this is a really fun one. I'm going to let Jack answer this one because I think he's been really in the details here. But I can't underemphasize how excited we are for this next era. So Jack, tell him what we got working on.
So you know how like initially I mentioned we designed this workflow, the LLM is very on rails and it can only select certain tools. At certain steps, it can only select a very small subset of tools. So where we want to go is we want to go to, I don't know, I'm trying to not use the word agentic, but I think if you use a modern top tier tool like Cursor, you can see that what it does is it has like a huge list of tools that has available to it. But what I think the signature feature of these top tier tools is that they have a initial planning step. And sometimes it's hidden in the UI, but usually it comes up with a list of, hey, here are four steps, right? In our example of like a coding task, oh, I want you to write a piece of code that does this. And so usually the LLM will say, first of all, I'm going to look at your code base and see what is the context that you're working in. Then I'm going to maybe write a test that expects this behavior. Then I'm going to run the test. Then I'm going to write the code. Then I'm going to run the test again. And so it writes all this out before it actually does, I guess, anything. And then it goes through the list and it goes step by step and actually calls the appropriate tool for each step. And at any step, it can make a decision like, hey, do the next steps make sense? Did I even accomplish this step correctly? So we want to take that approach with Alex. And I think a really great example of one of the first applications we're going to apply this to is writing a prompt or optimizing your prompt. Everyone has prompts and you freehand write it and then you run it and it's like it works and it works 80% of the time, or at least when you test it, it works pretty well and you want to optimize it. And what do you do? Like, how do you even start? And so I think that's where Alex comes in. So again, it goes along the lines of we're guiding you to use our product in a way that we would use our product. So what would you do? First of all, you want to check, are there evals, right? Like, how do we even judge that the prompt is better? Okay, if there's no evals, maybe Alex will take a little tangent and write you an eval. I want to make the prompt better. How? I wanted to hallucinate less. Okay, first of all, Alex will write you an eval that's, here's if the information, if the response doesn't match the information that's provided, then it's a hallucination. And then it'll run that eval, right? It'll say, okay, you have 100 examples where someone asked a question and let's see what percent has hallucinated. Okay, now you have maybe, we'll run the eval in our platform. Hey, it looks like 30% of your evals say hallucinated on your example data set. And then Alex will go to the next step, which is, okay, now I'm gonna try to see what I can do in this prompt. Maybe I'll look at some examples of the bad evals, right? Like I'm looking at some, picking some of these examples where it hallucinated. How can I rewrite that prompt in order to make it hallucinate less? Go on that loop. So in this case, it's a little bit less on rails. It's a little bit more free to revisit steps, take tangents. If it revisits a step too many times, it may try a completely different strategy. So basically taking advantage of modern LLMs, and by modern, I mean less than, I guess, 9 months old or a year old, but taking advantage of the power of like modern LLMs, giving it more flexibility, more kind of range of motion. And I think that will make it more powerful and also more flexible to answer questions that may not fall under that decision tree structure that we talked about before, but obviously can be answered by some combination of the data that's available to the LLM. So we're really excited about it. We're talking about figuring out how to make it plan steps, execute those steps, but really critically evaluate, do the steps make sense and did I complete the step?
That was such a great example of the like reflective loop of, I want to change this prompt. Why do you want to change the prompt? I want to reduce hallucinations. Okay, can we detect hallucinations? Yeah. Okay, let's get a baseline. Okay, now change the prompt. Did we improve the hallucinations? So that was amazing. One, separate from Alex. And then two, if Alex can do that, I definitely need an Alex. So yeah. Maybe to wrap up, tell us, how do people learn more about Alex? How do we get our hands on it? Where do we go?
Yeah, you can definitely sign up at app.arise.com. I highly recommend you get a free account, get started with the use case. I think by the time that this release, that skill that Jack is talking about, or at least one iteration of it, will be available in the product.
Amazing.
And just to even expand on that, what Jack's talking about is going to make Arise AI-driven. I think we expect to see Alex being in the driver's seat across the platform, so we're really excited about that. But check us out. Find us on LinkedIn. We post a lot. We have a blog, and we try to share back as much as possible. That is something that's been really important for Jack and I, is that we've learned a lot of painful lessons that we don't want you all to have to learn. And so anytime we come across one of those bridges that we're like, damn, if only somebody could tell us, we try to write it down. Definitely make sure you're following the Arise blog so you get all of those learnings.
That is amazing. And we'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Thank you both. This has been really great. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, happy to do it. Thanks for the invite and looking forward to it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Teresa. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and give us a rating as it helps others find the show. Thanks, I appreciate it.